served at the Pentagon as an Army JAG. He graduated from Notre Dame and has two law degrees from Boston University and Georgetown University. He's been practicing law for over 30 years. He's your family's personal attorney. It's time for the David Carrier Show.
Good morning and welcome to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. You have found the place where we talk about estate planning, elder law, real estate, and business law. So give us a shout, why don't you? 888-463-2843. If you have a question, comment, or concern about wills, trusts, or probate, if you're wondering how does that Medicaid stuff work, if you're wondering, you know, can I only get help with long-term care if we're in a skilled nursing facility, or is are other forms of help available? Well, give us a call, 888-463-2843. That's 888-463-2843. You can also use that number to sign up for one of our free life plan workshops. These are the workshops we do every single week. Actually, we're doing them twice a week now, just so you don't have to wait that long. And if you do feel like, you know, if you're one of those planning people, you know, Do you already have your shopping plans ready for Christmas? I mean, if you haven't already bought the stuff, I mean. So that you're saying, oh, yeah, the day after Thanksgiving, you know, we'll be up and at 'em, 5 a.m., 2 a.m., whenever. Well, we have plans for the day after Thanksgiving as well. That's called Black Friday. And the Black Friday workshops, we've got two of them, not filled up yet. Surprising. It's not even Halloween, and we don't have our Black Friday workshops filled up yet. Something very important to know about the Black Friday workshop. We do two of these. Now, I used to do one, but the demand was such we added another. The key to the Black Friday workshop is this. Pie. P-I-E, pie. That's right. Pumpkin pie, mince pie, French silk pie. I don't know. Whatever pie Panera has. Whatever leftover pies we can find. That's what's going to be at the Black Friday workshop. That's what distinguishes it from all the others. But the Black Friday workshop is also an opportunity. You know, you got everybody in town, all right? Why don't we all get together, come on down, and, you know, have a family conversation about this stuff. It's important stuff, really important stuff, I believe. And the Black Friday workshop is one way for you to get cranking on it. We've got Corey on the line. Good morning, Corey. Welcome to the David Carrier Show.
Good morning, David.
How can I help?
Yes, you were highly recommended. Regarding a not-for-profit trust, my objective is to donate $8,500 here in San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. Although it doesn't have to be specific for California. I know you're out of state. And I am going to just draft this and show it to another lawyer. However, what my question is I will be the grantor providing the $8,500 to a not-for-profit association.
Okay.
They're not a 501c.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically to help create jobs and things like that.
Okay.
And there will be a trustee, and he will be using his Social Security number on the bank account.
Okay.
And it is an irrevocable trust, and I want to first protect the assets. The second priority is to avoid probate if I pass away. And I'm not real concerned about taxes. That's the last thing. Now, I know that generally irrevocable trusts need the tax identification number.
Well, that's not really necessarily true. Here's the thing, Corey. With most irrevocable trusts are typically done for tax purposes. And you just say, well, I don't care about the tax purposes. Okay, I'm with you on that. The thing is, though, that the tax planning trusts have always, if you're going to do a trust for tax planning purposes, whether it's estate tax, income tax, what have you, in order to get the tax benefits, then you have to get the tax ID. There's all kinds of IRS requirements that they put on an irrevocable trust to qualify it as a tax trust. Now, we do lots of irrevocable trusts that have nothing to do with taxes, because what we're trying to do is preserve assets for families in case of long-term care and all the rest. You know, asset protection in case of lawsuits and long-term care. Well, these are not tax-qualified trusts. There is no tax ID number. And I was kind of curious, you mentioned that a friend of yours was going to use their Social Security number on the trust account. Now, how's that going to happen? If you you'd have to give that person the money, then they would have to create the trust in order to use their own Social Security number on the thing properly. You know, is that the idea?
It's a trustee that's not connected with the beneficiary nonprofit, and what I've written into the draft trust document is that I will I'm providing my Social Security number in the document,
okay,
and I'm agreeing to pay the taxes if they're under $600. That's that new $600.
But wait a second, Corey. Hang on just a minute. You're talking about the $600 of income on the trust, and then if it's more than $600, then the trust has got to pay taxes, right?
Yeah, and then right. If it's more than $600, then the beneficiary would pay the taxes.
Hang on just a minute. Here's the thing. Because this is not, at least I don't think it's going to be, a tax-qualified trust, okay, because it's going to be treated as a grantor trust, I believe, then there is no $600. It pays tax at your rate of tax. That doesn't change. It's just because you're not going to, what I'm hearing is that you're not going to set this thing up in such a way that it would qualify as an independent entity. You're going to use your own tax ID number. You're going to use your buddy's tax ID number, meaning that you have such control over the assets, over the disposition of the assets, that the IRS is going to say, hey, that's what we call a grantor trust. It's a disregarded entity. That's the only way you get to use your own tax ID number, your own Social Security number, okay? And you retain complete control over it, but you don't have to worry about the trust tax rules because it's not viewed as an independent entity. It's just what we call a grantor trust. And you can do an irrevocable trust that way, and you can get asset protection. You get other benefits from it. I mean, we do those every, two or three times a day, as a matter of fact. But you don't get a new tax. You don't have to get the new tax ID number, and you really don't have to worry about the, trust tax consequences, because there aren't any. It's all attributed back to you.
I guess the main priority then, what I'm trying to do is get the asset protection and the nonprofit association does not have a tax ID number, so I need to use my tax ID number. Would that be permitted where it's asset protected?
Sure. Yeah, you can set up an irrevocable trust where you say, look, I'm putting the money in this trust. Me personally, have no right to take the principal or the income out of the trust. However, I can change the beneficiary of the trust. That right, I retain the right to change the investments in the trust. I retain the right to change the trustees of the trust. And when I die, nobody else can change those things, but I can do it while I'm alive. If you do that, then it all gets taxed to you, and if you get sued, provided you're not already being sued, then that you're going to get some asset protection as well. Yeah, it's doable.
Yes, understood. So I would simply put my Social Security number in the trust document and not the beneficiaries, so that it works. But
well, I'd be pretty slow about putting my Social Security number in the document. I wouldn't you know, just as a drafting thing, there's no reason for you to put your Social Security. No, I wouldn't do that. But understand that the income from the trust is going to get taxed to you. It's an irrevocable trust, yes. And you have limited access to it, yes. And you have asset protection, yes. Can do all those things. Still gets taxed to you. Still get asset protection. And you have a high degree of confidence that it is going to go to your ultimate charitable beneficiary. Yeah, that's all.
Right. Now,
Corey, that music means that we're up against a hard break. You're listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Welcome back to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. This is, of course, the place where we talk about estate planning, elder law, real estate, and business law. We've still got Corey from San Diego on the line. Good morning, Corey. Welcome back.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah, still here.
Again?
Yeah. Well, are we all set there? The idea here is if you want to set up an irrevocable trust to benefit a nonprofit, which is not apparently formally organized, doesn't have its approval letter yet from the IRS. Does it have Tea Party in the name? Maybe. Anyway, if that's the case, you certainly can do it. There are ways to accomplish that goal, but it's just got to be done right. It's like anything else. Okay.
Yes, understood. Now, one other.
Sure.
I had mentioned that the trustee would be using their Social Security number to open the $8,500 bank account. Is that permissible?
Nope. Well, unless you get, here's the thing. You could give the money to that person, and that person could do whatever they felt like doing with the money. And if they just happen to feel like setting up an irrevocable trust like we've been talking about in their own name, then they could use their own Social Security number. But, you know, if they took that $8,500 and decided to find the way to San Jose, well, that's up to them. Because at that point,
right,
you've given them the money. But you would not have recourse.
It's a no-no regarding the safety of the money, but it's not against the law or against the bank's policy or anything like that, is it?
Not if you've given the money. Right. Not if you've given the money to the person, and that person decides to set up the same kind of trust that we've been talking about, and just happens to use it, you know, for what you wanted them to use it for. Well, yeah, they could do that, and the same rules would apply. Sure.
Well, they would want to leave it under the same trust structure that I just mentioned.
Right.
The reason that the trustee would put their Social Security number in is so that the bank can see that is their account,
right,
so they can build their credit.
Right.
That's the only reason we would use the. So I guess we have an option of using either my Social Security number as the settlor or the trustee's Social Security number as the trustee. Right.
Well, the thing is, the only way that you'd be able to use the trustee's number is if they are acting as the settlor. That's what I'm saying. If you give him the money and let you let that successor trustee, that person, set up the account, that's the only way that they'd be able to use their own Social Security number. That's it.
But you'd have to give it to them,
not as trustee.
Yeah, we've already done that. So what are the bad things that will happen because we already use the trustee's Social Security number?
Well, it just means that you gave him the money. That's all.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
We can still maintain the possible structure we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Okay. Thank you so much, David.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for calling, Corey. We've got Don on the line. Hi, Don. Welcome to the David Carrier Show.
Hello.
Hello. How can we help?
This is John, not Don.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
All right, George, you're now in big trouble. Don, not John. John, not Don.
There you go.
Is it Don Juan? Whatever. Okay. So, Don, what's up? John, what's up?
Now that we got that clear.
Yeah, thank God for that. Yeah.
My question is about Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare.
Sure.
As you're probably aware, some of the best estimates are that about 16 million Americans are going to be shunted into Medicaid almost involuntarily.
Only 16?
Only $16 million, yeah.
Oh, it's going to be a heck of a lot more than that.
On top of the $70 million that are already in it.
Right.
And so I keep hearing you talking about on your discussions about what happens to people's real estate when they're put into Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what the general implications are for everybody under Obamacare if they unhappily get stuck into Medicaid. Do states automatically put liens on their mortgages?
Yeah, it's a state by state deal. Each state has its own rules, and some of them, like for example, West Virginia has a very stringent rule. Okay, the rule as it's written is very. Strict, you might say, or extreme, or I don't know, it's very harsh, depending on, it's a strict rule, okay? But the way they enforce it is very lax, to avoid a revolution, I think. So, the problem you have with a rule like that is, and this is one of the, I'll tell you what, this is a fundamental problem we've got with this Obamacare, and with an awful lot of the way the federal government is set up these days with the laws that they've passed. Like, if they decide that they want you, okay, if they decide they're going to get you, right, you've probably already today broken half a dozen federal laws, probably, okay? There's so many federal laws that cover so many different things. What it gets down to is, are they going to decide to come after you? You remember Gibson Guitar, right? They had some imported wood. Well, it was certified, it was clarified, it was all the rest of this. Didn't matter. They came in and they seized the wood under the law and went to prosecute them, and rather than go through the whole rigmarole, they pled guilty to something. I forget what. But the point is that there are so many rules and there's so many laws that so here's the thing with the estate recovery. Once they put the law in place, it's no comfort for anybody to think, well, they're not going to enforce it like that, okay? Or we're going to get some slack here or something like this. So long as the law is in place, then you just have to assume the worst. And that's the attitude I take, frankly. Whenever we do a Medicaid application, we don't assume that we're going to get any slack, we're going to get any rhythm, we're going to get any easing of the requirement or anything. 5 years of bank statements, on and on, all this information, because that's what's required. We don't overlook any gift, however small. We use it, we report it, because if you don't do that, and the caseworker is having a bad day, or the word comes down on high, we've got to enforce the strict letter of the rules. Well, it's no consolation that, well, we got by with this before. You see? And the bad thing about that is it puts a lot of power in the hands of the people who get to decide which rule they're going to follow. Okay? We're up against a hard break. John, if you don't mind hanging on, we'll take this up when we get back after the news. You've been listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Welcome back to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. And this is the place, of course, where we talk about estate planning, elder law, real estate, business law. We've got John from Alto on the line. And John, I'm not really quite sure, John, how to sum up your... he called 888-463-2843, and you can too. What's the question, observation? Help me out here.
Well, you know what? If I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that Obamacare is designed to put people in Medicaid so the government can steal our property.
Well, I wouldn't. I don't think you have to be a conspiracy theorist for the first half. The steal the property. You start getting off into the woods on that one. But it seems pretty clear that the goal is single payer. I mean, they've said it. I mean, who hasn't said it? Nancy Reed. Nancy Pelosi said it. Harry Reid said it. The president said it. We're on the way to single payer. And what is Medicaid but single payer? Yeah, I don't think you have to be a theorist at all to think that that's the way things are going.
Well, what am I going to do to stop it from happening to me?
You vote and you talk to other people, who like-minded folks, and you spread the word. That's what you do. It's a political process.
So is it your opinion that people who are 55 years old, who lost their longtime careers because of what's happened here in this country,
mm-hmm.
and who have some savings and who've seen their income reduced dramatically, maybe, 50, 60%, and they're just on the edge of having to maybe think that they're going to get stuck into Medicaid. Are you telling us that we have a reason to fear that liens are going to be put against our real estate where we live, and that we're going to possibly lose our homes, or we'll lose our economic freedom because of a lien put on our property?
Well, that's not a theory. I mean, that's what's happening in at least 48 other states. When you apply for Medicaid, they put a lien on your property. Yeah. I mean, that's what they do. Go to Massachusetts or Florida. I mean, that's how it works. You apply for Medicaid. Now the Medicaid lien goes on. And as a matter of fact, after the last session of the legislature, I was surprised. The surprise was not that they were thinking about doing this, because they've had legislation like this pending ever since 07. In 07 was when they passed the estate recovery law that said, okay, if you go through probate, we're coming after your stuff. Well, the original version of that legislation was when you apply for Medicaid, we're going to put a lien on your house. And that was the original legislation. What passed was this: if you go through probate. Now, they didn't enforce it for a couple of years, didn't enforce it at all until a couple of years ago in July now, 3 years ago in July. They started enforcing the "if you go through probate, we're coming after your stuff" law. Now, most other states, and in fact in Michigan as well, they put together a law that would say, when you apply, we're putting the lien on your stuff, whatever you've got, to pay back the Medicaid. And the law, unlike before, see, in previous years, somebody had introduced the bill and it never went, they referred it to committee, never went anywhere. But the last time, it got all marked up, they had the hearings on it, they did work on the bill, okay? And so it was in a shape so that you would think, I did think, maybe you wouldn't think, but I thought, hey, they're serious about this, they're going to pass it this time around. But they didn't. They didn't pass the lien law. So it doesn't mean they forgot about it, it just means they didn't pass it the last time around. But they did the work on the bill to get it ready to pass. So the next time this comes up, the next time the legislature takes up this sort of business, they're much further down the path than they have been at any other time. That's the way I'm looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, and it's no conspiracy theory, simply to observe that the effect of a lot of this stuff is to push people. You've got all these employer-based plans, right? You go to work and you get the... And the reason for that, just a little history, the reason for that is during World War II, there were wage controls. You couldn't pay people extra money, but you
right.
could give them health insurance. And so that's
right.
how people, that's how businesses competed for workers, was with these benefits. Well, that carried, for the last 70 years now, it's been the same, 60 years, it's been the same old thing. That's why we have the employers providing the health insurance. Now,
yes.
if you're in the government, depending on your perspective, you kind of resent that somebody else is a big player. And you say, well, wait a second, we got to get those people out of the business of providing health insurance. How are we going to do that? Well, we'll tell you that if you like your plan, you can keep it. Hardy har har. Not true. But we'll tell you that because that's what you want to hear. And then when the reality bites, you'll find out that the employer isn't going to keep that plan because you set the table in such a way that makes it very difficult now. Instead of encouraging employers to offer health insurance, you make it difficult, you make it more expensive, you provide other alternatives to the employer-based plan, and that's what these exchanges, which don't work, that's what they're doing. I'm just observing the movement from one system to another. It's not a conspiracy, it seems to me, just to say, hey, the sky's blue today. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a, are they trying to grab your property? I don't know. I have no opinion on that. But, the piper's got to be paid, and, you know, and well, so, the piper's so jealous of any others, you know. They want to be so the only one calling the tune.
I'm gonna have to make a choice here whether to continue to go with a regular, you know, health insurance plan or with a Medicaid plan. And you know, I can actually adjust my income enough so that I can stay out of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of Americans won't be able to do that.
Yeah.
But let's say I'm a healthy person, I'm 55 and I go into Medicaid and suddenly I reach 65 and I've had after 10 years I've had say $10,000 worth of medical bills which have been paid out of Medicaid. And then I try to sell my house and move to a retirement apartment somewhere and I find there's a lien on my property.
Yeah, but I mean that's you number one, you'd know about it, but about the lien you wouldn't discover it at that point, but the scenario that would be pretty unusual. The way you'd usually think of it working would be the if you wound up in a long-term care situation. I mean, that's where, you know, where most people wind up in the Medicaid right now, regular folks, working folks, people with stuff. The way you wind up in the Medicaid is not for your basic health insurance. I mean, that's not it. Typically, because of their asset tests and everything for that, it's when we're talking about long-term care. You know, that's what wipes out regular folks, people who've been saving, people who've been planning ahead. What wipes them out is the nursing home. That's, whether it's $7,631 per month, which is what the state says it costs, or $10,000 a month, which is what, $8,000 to $10,000 a month, which is what we're seeing in the real world. That's what people are actually paying, private pay. You know, that's what wipes people's savings out. It's not the regular cost of healthcare. You know, it's not.
Whether it wipes it out or not, though, it sounds like you're saying that there will be cost recovery attempts made, just for routine healthcare that people will have incurred. You know, costs they've incurred under Medicaid until between
I guess I wouldn't be surprised at that, but my concern, what I see on the horizon is the more stringent enforcement, more new laws designed to make more effective estate recovery based on the long-term care. We'll let you keep your house while you're alive, but that's about it. Okay? Am I getting the high sign here? Yeah, I'm getting the... He's holding up his fingers. I don't know what's going on. We'll be right back. You've been listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Welcome back to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney, inviting you to call 888-463-2843, also known as 888-GO-DAVID, if you'd like to sign up for one of our free life plan workshops. You know, we've gone sort of... pillar to post here, right? From the ridiculous to the sublime in terms of philosophy and everything else in terms of today's show. What is money to is Obamacare really a conspiracy to grab our stuff? But in the lightning round, we're now into the lightning round. What I'd like to do is see if we could knock out about half a dozen of these emails we've gotten. So let me just... let's see if we can knock them out. Can I sue a sibling? Question. Can I sue a sibling who may or may not have power of attorney over our parent who has loans against our parent's life insurance? At the time of the loan, the parent was at the beginning stages of dementia or Alzheimer's. Loan used for personal reasons, not for the care of the parent. Parent's intention was to use funds for burial, balance divided among surviving children. Okay, let's just take the facts as they are. Let's assume that this is... that you're right about all this, which is big question marks, frankly, in terms of the presumptions that are being made about what the parent's intention was and all the rest. Number one red flag here, it says beginning stages of dementia. A lot of people do a lot of estate planning at the beginning stages of dementia. In fact, for many people, that's the wake-up call that finally that's the wake-up call that finally gets through. It's like, oh, I've got a diagnosis now. Holy cow, maybe I should do something, all right? I mean, just because you have the diagnosis doesn't mean that you are not capable of making decisions for yourself. And we have people years after the diagnosis, because of the some of the things that are available now, are still doing very well, very rational and all the rest. So just because someone has gotten a diagnosis does not mean that they're not competent to make the decisions. But the question is, can I sue the sibling? And the answer is no, not without power of attorney. If you don't have power of attorney, you certainly cannot. But if you are concerned that one of your siblings is ripping off your parents, right, even if they have power of attorney, you're not helpless. You're not hopeless. What you can do is you can go to the probate court. You need counsel, of course, but you can go to the probate court and say, hey, judge, Jimmy over here is ripping off mom and dad. And the judge says, what do you want me to do about it? And you say, hey, judge, I want you to appoint me representative for mom and dad so I can figure out if Jimmy's ripping them off. And I really think he is. And then Jimmy says, oh, yeah, but judge, I've got this power of attorney. See, I'm the one who should be in charge. And then you say, yeah, but Jimmy, you're ripping off mom and dad because blah, 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 blah. You know, you took the loans against the life insurance and you bought that skateboard that you brought to court here today and, you know, you used it for your personal use. Are you with me on this? You have to get appointed by the probate court in order to go after him. You can't just do it because Jimmy's your little brother and he's always been a jerk. My grandmother might have left me money in a will, but no one will tell me for sure. Okay. Both of my parents died when I was young, sadly. I just recently found older brother. How about that? He claims that our father's mother left him, my brother, and me. Our father's mother left him, my brother, and me. Are they talking about the father or the other brother? Who knows? But anyway, grandma left money about 10 years ago when she died, apparently. How would I go about finding whether or not this is true? Well, the first thing you do is you go to the county where grandma died. And you go to the probate court and you say, hey, probate court, do you have a probate estate or probate will or anything involving grandmother? The answer is yes. Oh, good. Let's look it up. Because when someone dies, even if there is no probate, you're supposed to, under the law, you're supposed to file that will with the probate court. People don't usually do that, but you know, they're supposed to. And so maybe it did happen, okay? Maybe you did get it, and if you did, that's wonderful. That's good. And we're going to, then we can see, okay, did she really leave you anything? What if there is no will? What if there was no probate? Typical. Then you can go through the register of deeds, but in 10 years, that property's going to be gone. So that's not going to work. What else can we do? Well, most states have an abandoned property website, someplace where you can go to say, did anybody pay money on behalf of grandma over to the state because they lost grandma? Okay, so let's say there's no probate. We can't go that route. And we think that grandma had money. Well, maybe they weren't able to find you. Maybe the insurance company wasn't able to find you after, I think it's 2 years. It depends on the state. They have to pay that money over to the state government. It's called escheat. It is cheats to the state. But the state says, yeah, great, it's ours now if nobody claims it. But if somebody wants it, we'll give it back to you. So that's what I would do. First, check with the probate court. Nothing's going on in there. Then go to the state and go to the abandoned property list. Then most states have a website that'll facilitate that. My grandmother, oh, that's the one. How do I find out if a deceased person had a will? 4 question marks after that one. Mother-in-law passed away. She always said she had a will. Brother-in-law giving it. We answered this a little bit before, but the thing is, if you think somebody who died had a will, go to the probate court. Their obligation to file it. What if they're not filing it? Well, then did they have property in their own name? If they did, then they're supposed to file it. The problem here is that we're talking about your mother-in-law, and you are not an heir of your mother-in-law. In other words, you don't have standing. Okay, if there was a will, then you could take, assuming that your spouse, who's the child of your mother-in-law, has died, right? Then let's assume that's the case. Well, you don't have standing. I mean, it's not under the law. You're not an heir. You wouldn't take unless there's a will. So let's look and see if there's a will. Okay. Now here's the other thing. Most people don't do wills. Most people don't do any planning at all. Sad, but true. A consequence of that is that lots of times when people say, oh, I've got a will, don't worry, I've got it all taken care of, blah, blah, blah. Well, they're saying that. They're lying. Okay, they're lying. no two ways, bearing false witness, whatever. They're not telling you the truth. They're just doing it because they're so tired of being badgered about it. They feel guilty about not having done it, and they lie. Can't tell you the number of times that people have. But she always said, you know, we all knew that they did a will, they did a trust, but we can't find the will. We can't find the trust. There's no correspondence from an attorney. There's nothing in the safe deposit box. Okay. Well, if that's all true, okay, that there's not a scrap of paperwork to suggest that they actually did it, and all you've got is the memory of them telling you that they did, time to wake up and smell the coffee. They probably were not being as honest as possible. When I put my mother in assisted, another email, when I put my mother in assisted living, will I need to give back any money she's given me or my spouse over the last 3 years? My mother lives in Michigan now, as do I. She's most likely to be put in a home in another state. That is where she is from, and most family as well. The state here is Illinois. So living here, going to Illinois. Illinois just went to the 5-year look back. Up until very recently, it was a 36-month. Now it's 5 years. So it's not 3 years, it's 5 years is the look back there now. And when you, when someone needs assisted living, generally speaking, at that point, they're not on the Medicaid. They're not using Medicaid benefits. And this is really a Medicaid question. If I give property away, will I have to? Will it count against that person? And the thing is, it's not a matter of you giving the money back, okay? What happens is when someone makes a gift, when they make, oh, I hear the music. Well, anyway, here's the deal. When they make the gift, they create a penalty period. They don't come after you. They simply deny benefits to your loved one, which amounts to the same thing in most cases. You've been listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Looking forward to seeing you at one of our Life Plan workshops.